Please turn in your Bibles to the book of Job, chapter 1, please. There's a statement which says there are no atheists in foxholes. And I think that's generally probably true. That when death is really close, if you ask somebody about eternity and what's beyond life, if they were an atheist all throughout their lives, there might be a hint of doubt in their answer. So long as death is being talked about in the third person, we're okay with that. But when it's in the first person, it becomes terrifying. You can call it sad, you can call it tragic, you can call it ironic. I don't know what to call it, but it amazes me how many times people are apt to think about God in bad times. And I said think about Him. Not necessarily seek for Him, but just to think about Him. Sometimes that thinking is positive. The Bible plays that out in the book of Judges when there was some really bad times with the Israelites. They would often seek God, and that's a positive thing. But they were less apt to think about Him when times were really good. But more often than not, the thoughts when times are bad are not positive. They're often negative. And that's when we start asking ourselves all of the why questions. Why me? Why now? Why this? Why didn't God spare me from this? Why didn't God spare that person from that? That happened on Monday. The explosion at the Boston Marathon. And you could plug in anything in the dot, dot, dot area. Why didn't God spare those three people? Why didn't God thwart the plan of the bombers? We're going to be looking at suffering from the perspective of the book of Job. Suffering is dealt with in the book of Job in a very, very unique way. It deals with suffering. But I want to make this very clear before we get into the book of Job, that all of the why questions, why me, why now, why didn't God do this, why didn't He spare me from this or spare somebody else from that, they are not answered in Job. That is a common misconception. So there is a distinction between dealing with suffering and having all of the answers. And what you find out from the book of Job is that the answer is that there's no answer. I've always found it fascinating that at the end of Job, that God never comes back to Job and says, Job, let me tell you about the conversations I had with Satan. I really kind of set this up, and I let Satan do these things to you because you were such an awesome character. There is no explanation given to Job at the end of the book. Now, we could say that faith in God, trusting in God, that is an answer in a very general way, and that is an answer. But when I say that the answer is that there's no answer, what I'm talking about is all of the why questions. Why me? Why now? Why this? Why didn't God spare me from this? There is no answer to those questions. All we have in the book of Job is how to deal with it from the perspective of Job and how God wants us to deal with it. The conclusion of the book is that all the why questions don't matter. What matters most is accepting God's sovereignty. That is the book of Job in a nutshell. But I want you to see some things for yourself this morning. So let's begin. Job chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. You'll see that Job has a lot going for him. 1 through 3 of chapter 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. He's got 3 things going for him, probably more than this, but just from these 3 verses, you find out from a carnal perspective that he's extremely rich. Now, it's hard to put a money sign on 7,000 camels and this, that, and the other, or 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels. But according to some commentaries that I went to, Job has more possessions than most cities of that particular time. Job is a multimillionaire, to say the least. He's got that going for him. He has a great family. He has 7 sons, 3 daughters. And as the text goes further, you find out that he cares for them extremely in a deep way. That he is oftentimes sacrificing for his kids in sins that they may or may not have committed. He cares about them deeply, just like you care about your family. And number three, and this is the most important, and please underline that in your mind, this is the most important thing about Job. He is through and through a man of God. He is described in 4 ways. Blameless man, upright, one who fears God and turns away from evil. And he'll be described in a different way, a 5th way, in chapter 2. But this is not a multimillionaire who is a deadbeat with his wife and kids. This is not a multimillionaire who gained his riches because he was a liar and a cheat, or somebody who doesn't have their priorities right. This man is of the highest kind, the greatest of all the people of the East. And God would end up saying to Satan that, spiritually speaking, he is the greatest man on the entire earth at this particular time. And Satan and the Lord, they have this conversation in verse 8. And I've always found this amazing, that God brings up Job to Satan. You would think that the accuser would bring Job up to God, but God brings up Job to Satan. Here we are in verse 8 now. The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Have you been watching this man? You know, these description of blameless, upright, one who fears God and turns away from evil, that's not a man's description of Job. That's God's description of Job. I've always thought it's so amazing that God thought so much of this man to bring him up. Have you considered this guy, Satan? And Satan's perspective is he's getting paid for it. Look at verse 9. Then Satan answered the Lord and says, "Did Job fear God for no reason? He's on the payroll. The reason why he's such a good man, he doesn't doubt that he is. He never doubts that he's a blameless man, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. What Satan is denying, or what he's accusing Job of, is wrong motives. Does he do it for no reason?" And then he kind of explains this in verse 10. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand, touch all that he has, he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand, only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. He's getting paid for it. The reason why he's such a good man, the Lord, he's telling the Lord this, is because you put a hedge around him. You've guarded him. You put a fence around him. You've blessed everything that he does. You know, if you take all that away, if you touch all that he has and start cursing him, he'll curse you to your face. And God lets Satan off the leash. I like to think of Satan on a leash, like a little dog or a cat. I hate cats, so I'll compare him to a cat, even though I've never seen a cat on a leash before. He lets him off the leash a little bit, and he says, you can touch him. You can touch all that he has, but you can't touch him, meaning you can't touch his body. And boy, does he do this. He touches everything that he has. A messenger comes into Job's house and says, "The Sabians have stolen your animals, some of your animals." A second messenger comes in and says, "Fire came down from the sky and they burned your sheep up." A third messenger came in and says, "The Chaldeans came down and they stole your camels." A fourth messenger comes in and says, "The house that your 7 sons and 3 daughters were in, that house came up off of its foundation, came crashing down, and all 10 of your kids are dead." 4 messengers come in, back to back to back to back, all giving him this bad news. Now, I want you to think about what Job has lost. Just about everything, right? His millions, his retirement fund, you name it, it's all gone. You can't farm your land without some of those animals. And none of those things really touch the hem of the garment of actually losing 10 kids all at once. Now, how would you respond in a situation like that? If there was ever a man who had the right, who we would expect to answer all or ask all of those why questions, wouldn't it be Job in this position? Why didn't he just spare the kids? Why did he have to take all 10? Couldn't he have stopped this? And I dare say most of us wouldn't blame Job if he did ask those questions. And believe me, Job gets a little loud in the book, and we'll talk about that. But just enjoy, respect his initial response in verse 20. Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell on the ground, and worshipped. By the way, that was the same response that King David had when he lost a little one. It's a time for worship. He worshipped. Verse 21, he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God. We're all breaking even in the end. That to me is a good paraphrase of what Job is saying. I'm going to break even. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. It's not ours to begin with. And brethren, this is all true of us. Paul said something very similar in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 7. We have brought nothing into the world and we cannot take anything out of it. We all came into this world with our birthday suits on and that's it. And that's all we're going to take out. No possessions. No family relationships, not in the physical sense anyway. I know that we can, if we have our spiritual family, we'll take them and see them later. But in a very real physical sense, we will not take anything with us. We're all breaking even. And my encouragement is this. Be grateful for what we have as long as we have it. Now you might be saying, well, that's not very comforting to a man who's lost 10 kids. I never said that it was going to be. This is only the response of the most spiritual man who lived on the face of the earth at this time. And then it gets worse, if you can imagine. The Lord and Satan have another meeting at the beginning of chapter 2. Look at verse 3. The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? What's he like now? Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" And then he adds a fifth characteristic. He still holds fast his integrity. We're going to talk about integrity here in just a moment. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. What's he like now, Satan? Have you tried him now? Have you been looking at him now? You said that if we took away all of his possessions, that he would curse me to his face. Have you been looking at this? And Satan does what a lot of people do. You know, when you're cornered and when you realize you're wrong, you know what people do a lot of times? They'll change the subject or they'll change their reasoning all of a sudden. Well, that's a tactic Satan's been using for thousands of years. His tactic now is not his possessions, but you got to touch his skin. Skin for skin is what he says in verse 4. Then Satan answered the Lord, "Skin for skin. All that a man has, he'll give for his life." So now it's not just his possessions, but you got to touch his body. You got to touch his flesh and blood. And if you threaten his life, all that a man has, he'll give up for his life. And remarkably, God lets a little more off the leash. God tells him, you can touch his body, but another restriction is you cannot kill Job. And what happens next to Job is rather disgusting. He forms these boils on the top of his head all the way to the bottom of his feet. And all he can do to get some sort of remedy or feel better is to take a piece of pottery, a broken piece of pottery, and scrape these boils. And you can imagine all of the gooey pus all over Job. Anyone want to go out to lunch afterwards? We can talk about the gooey pus all over Job. But seriously, he's handling this well, but his wife isn't. Check out verse 9. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." Can you imagine hearing that from a best friend, from a spouse? A man that's lost millions, all of his possessions, his 10 kids, and now his wife wants him to throw in the towel. Curse God and die. And the way she asks it almost is a hint of, you're stupid for trying. Do you still hold fast your integrity? Give it up already. I love the word integrity. It's one of my favorite English words. It's deep for our English language. I looked up the Hebrew word that is translated into our English word integrity, and that's a pretty deep word too. It means completeness or an unbroken state, meaning this man, Job, he could not be broken. You know what I think of when I think of integrity? You do right because it's right. You don't do right because your wife is doing right. You don't do right because you're a multimillionaire. You don't do right because things are going well. You do right because it's the right thing to do. Now, with that in mind, look at what he says in response to his wife. He kind of rebukes her at the first. Woman, you done lost your mind, is how we would kind of paraphrase it. He says in verse 10, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. I want to put that up on the board. That question. Shall we receive good and not adversity? Now, the New American Standard is the one that uses the word adversity. I like that word better because trials and suffering, they're not necessarily evil. Trials in and of themselves are not evil. Now, somebody might be putting you through a trial because they're doing something evil, but not all suffering is evil in a sense. So I like the word adversity better. Are we going to receive this good stuff, but not with the bad? You know, how come we don't hear all the why questions when things are really, really good? Why is the Lord so good to me? Ever heard that question? I have, but it's from members of the church who feel that they are overwhelmingly blessed, and they will say things like, I have no idea why the Lord has blessed me so much. So I have heard it. But overwhelmingly, you hear, why is the Lord letting this happen? Why didn't he spare this person? Why me? Why now? Why this? For example, when a child is born, do we ever say, why did the Lord bless me with this child? But when a child dies, you'll hear people ask, why didn't the Lord spare him or her? Why did the Lord bless me with this job? But when we lose a job and the bills are piling up and the mortgage bill is going down the tubes, all of a sudden now we're starting, you see, but Job gets it. Are we going to receive all the good things and not the adversity? The rain falls on the just and the unjust, the righteous and the unrighteous. And we must understand that as many trials as we have so much to be thankful for as well. So remember this when you're going through bad times. I'll leave that up on the board for later. And you'll see why. I'm going to have to paraphrase or lump chapters 3 through about 31. And I'll try to get it all in, and then this comes later. But Job's friends show up on the scene. He has three friends. And to use Job's term, they are miserable comforters. Now that's Job's term. I don't think that they were miserable friends. I think that they were just miserable comforters. And the reason why the comfort that the three friends are bringing is because they come from the wrong perspective. They are dead wrong in trying to get Job to change. Here's the perspective that the three friends are coming from. Job, you have to be in sin. You have to be dead wrong. There's something in your life that is not right with God because innocent people do not suffer. And let me say again, they are wrong. Innocent people do suffer sometimes. People who are right with God do suffer sometimes. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12 says, all who wish to live a godly life will suffer persecution. There's going to be some ridicule. There's going to be some loss of friends. The book of Hebrews says it a little bit more of a poetic way. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 8, it says that if we're without discipline, we're illegitimate. It's like we don't have parents. We don't have a spiritual father if there's no discipline in being a Christian. So I say again, they come from the wrong perspective, and they accuse Job of being in sin. And just like any argument does, it escalates and gets personal. They go from saying, Job, we know you have to have done something wrong. And then they go from that to saying, Job, we know you're evil and rebellious. And then they go from that to say, look, I'm going to point out some specific things. We know you shun the poor. And we know you took advantage of widows. And we know you took advantage of the fatherless. And they go as far as to say, we know you're lusting after other women. I mean, you insult a man's marriage. Those are fighting words. And this is just my opinion, but it seems to me that the more personal the friends get, the more angry Job gets. That's kind of how men are a lot of times. Don't get too personal, otherwise we'll get a little more upset. And Job, in his response constantly, is always defending his innocence. No, I'm not in sin. I haven't done what you're telling me to do, or what you've said I've done. And he even goes as far, listen, and this is where he oversteps his bounds. He even goes as far as to say, if I just had a meeting with God, I would show you my innocence. And I'd show God my innocence. And he goes as far in chapter 24 as to question why God delays his judgment. And he even questions whether God even charges anyone with wrong. Well, guess who's listening to all this? God is. Turn to chapter 38. A fourth guy shows up, kind of a mysterious character, Elihu. I think I'm pronouncing that right. I'm going to skip over that character and jump straight to the response of God, and you'll see why we have this picture on the board. Verse 1 of chapter 38 says, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. There we go. Out of the whirlwind. Do a study sometime about when God actually speaks out loud. Not through the prophets, not through his apostles. When God actually speaks from heaven, what you'll find out is that 99% of the time, not always, like in the Garden of Eden, you don't necessarily see this. But nature, it goes bonkers when the Lord talks. Thunders, lightnings, storms. So, I don't think this is a figure of speech. I really don't. When it says the whirlwind, I think nature was going bonkers. And the Lord has a few things to say to Job. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. I want you to hone in on the question, who is this? You know, this is the same Job that God brought up to Satan. And he named those five characteristics about him. The blameless, upright, fearing God, turning away from evil, holding fast to his integrity. He knew exactly who Job is, And now you have the sense of, I don't even know who this is. The Job of chapter 38 is much different from the Job of chapters 1 and 2. And you can see that there's been a downward spiral, you could call it. And so he tells Job, I want you to dress like a man. Gird up your loins, some translations say. I've got a few questions that I want you to answer. And Job is totally humbled by all of the questions, as we should be, because Job cannot answer one of these questions. And we can't answer them either. Just to give you a taste, look at verse 4. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. You know, I've met some people who think that God doesn't ever have any sarcasm. You've never read Job. Sarcasm really drives some points home. Tell me, if you have the understanding, who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? Look at verse 12. Have you commanded the morning? You ever told the sun to rise? Have you ever commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place? Drop down to verse 16. Have you entered the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? You ever walked down there at the bottom of the ocean, Joe? You know, we've got scuba gear in 2013 that can't go down that deep. You know what's down there? You ever been down there? Look at verse 18. Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare, if you know all this, where is the way to the dwelling of light? And where is the places of darkness that you take to its territory and that you discern the paths of its home? Drop down to verse 35, if you will. Can you send forth lightning? Can you actually make that happen? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Who can tilt the water skins of the heavens? It's like God has water skins, and when he wants it to rain, he just tilts them over. Go to chapter 40. And the Lord said to Job, this is the end of the first class, first school session. Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it. Verse 3, then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once and I will not answer twice and I will proceed no further. I'm done talking, Job says. I'm going to lay my hand on my mouth. I realize that I am of small account. You know what God says? Sit back down, son. I'm not done with you. I've got some more questions. Verse 6. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, dress for action like a man. I will question you and you make it known to me. And this question in verse 8, I think really captures the heart of this sermon. Will you put me in the wrong? There it is. Are you going to put me in the wrong? You don't even know these questions. So when we ask, why me? Why now? Why this? Why didn't God stop the three people from dying in Boston? Why didn't he thwart the plan of the bombers? You going to put God in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? Have you an arm like God, and can you thunder with a voice like his? Drop down to chapter 42, please. I know we're going through this quickly. Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. That saying reminded me of Nebuchadnezzar. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar, this should all be fresh on our minds from the class that we just took on Daniel. When Nebuchadnezzar was made into an animal, and he came to his senses, and he ended up praising God, this is one of the things that he said. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. No one can stay the hand of God. I guess this is a proper response if you're truly humbled before him. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you make it known to me. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. I don't mean to be disrespectful or insensitive to anyone that may be going through suffering or a trial, but this is the main point. Who are you? Who am I? And when we get a little loud, Are we going to put God in the wrong? Are we going to blame him that we may be right? And then the book ends by God blessing Job with even more than what he had before. But as I mentioned near the beginning of the lesson, it is fascinating. God never, ever offers an explanation to Job. Who are we to question God? You say, Alan, that's not very comforting. I never said that it was going to be. And that's why the book of Job deals with suffering in a very unique way. It doesn't offer any flowery explanations. It only gives us the way that we should deal with it, and that is trusting His power, that His purpose is being carried out. As weird as the scenarios may be played out in our lives. Please get out your songbook and turn to the Song of Invitation, 287. This lesson isn't very conducive in convincing someone to become a Christian. But you know, that question that's on the board, who are we to question God, that really can be applied to becoming a Christian. You know, God has laid out some things about us to do, for us to do in obedience to Jesus. We must hear His word, we must believe, we must repent and confess, and be baptized in the name of Jesus for the forgiveness of sins, and live by Christ's law for the rest of our lives. And whatever we run across that we say, well, that doesn't really make sense to me. I don't see why God would have me do that. I don't see why God would have me live like that. That question really is applicable. Who are we to question the plan of salvation? But if you have heard and you're ready to obey, we bid you to come as together we stand and sing.